Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
As Cadet Connolly mentioned in his introduction, I am by academic specialization a historian of ancient Greek philosophy, and Stoicism certainly falls under that heading. It came about in the 3rd century BC in Athens due to a guy named Zeno of Citium. There's another one, Cleanthes, Chrysippus. But back then, it was, you know, one among several leading philosophical systems. You still had the Aristotelians around, the Epicureans. Plato's Academy was still rolling, mostly filled with skeptical philosophers. But Stoicism soon gained in popularity over its rivals and hit a relative high point in the Roman Empire. This is where most of the Stoics, if you've encountered any, were writing. So this includes like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, though in several ways not a Stoic himself, Cicero. He was at least a very good expositor of the view. And while its popularity, you know, it waxes and wanes over the centuries, it's always had its adherents. And when I was so nicely invited to come out, I was not surprised when I was asked if I'd be willing to speak about Stoicism. It wasn't surprising because it is currently undergoing something of a resurgence these days. And the enthusiasm is not just confined to the academy, it's escaped the ivory tower and has become something close to a trend or fad. There are dozens of books on Stoicism published in recent years directed towards a general audience. These often take the form of self-help books. It's advertised as a way of life that, if adopted, will lead to both happiness and success. A lot of these are oriented towards businessmen. There's always a book like this. When I was young, it was Sun Tzu's Art of War. That's what you needed to read if you wanted to succeed in business. Now, more often, it's Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. If you want to be as successful as a Roman emperor, then that's what you need to be reading. But not just there. It's super popular in Silicon Valley among all the tech guys and in, for lack of a better expression, male-dominated online communities. This one is a little more curious, where you know people who are interested in resuscitating the virtues of masculinity are quite interested in it. I'm not sure if this actually is a good example of this Stoicism. We could talk about that later. And the self-help format isn't an anomaly. Even the ancient presentations of Stoicism take this form. So much of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations are written in this way, and Epictetus's Enchiridion is literally a handbook. Like, handbook is the traditional way of translating that title. Stoicism, it was never just a set of doctrines. It was always a way of life. It was meant to be practically adopted. Now, there are a lot of reasons why Stoicism has always remained fairly popular. There's much to say in its favor. And as the first half of my title's talk, right, the promises and pitfalls of Stoicism. On the promises side, there are many elements of Stoic philosophy that are worth adopting, and I plan to present them in the most appealing way possible. But I do have some criticisms. That's the pitfalls half. Any philosophical system that's intended to be realized practically as a general way of living will include some of the most deeply held commitments of those who adopt it. And so I'm sometimes hesitant to be too critical of Stoicism. Many take Stoicism to be largely responsible for them being able to navigate and overcome some of the periods in their life in which they confronted their greatest suffering. And so I don't want to trample on what has genuinely helped so many. But hopefully, even if you are inclined towards Stoicism and it's helped you a lot, the criticisms will make it better or stronger, or at least you'll get rid of some of the elements that you don't need to adopt. Right. But to see this, we need to start at the beginning and talk about what Stoicism is. So before I start saying what's great about it and what's wrong about it, we need to have something of a basic presentation. The core elements of the view are often captured in a slogan: to live in agreement with nature, and sometimes to live in accord with nature. This is supposed to be the goal of life. It's the sort of rule or maxim that one should endeavor to follow if one is to be truly happy. But in order to understand what it is to live in agreement with nature, we need to understand at least three things, right? We got to know what nature is, we got to know what we are, and we got to know how we and nature interface in a way that makes assessments of agreement and disagreement intelligible. So we'll start there. We'll start with the nature side of things. The Stoics believed that there was something they called the logos, an all-pervasive divine reason which governs the natural world. So logos is divine. It's sometimes called God or fate. Sometimes it's just referred to by the name Zeus. But this divine principle is immanent throughout the whole of creation and directs its development down to the smallest detail. It follows from this also that the universe is maximally rational. It's not just any principle, it's reason itself. So there's going to be a kind of fundamental orderliness to all things, how they're situated and how they unfold over time. Now this divine element, it's not something external to the world or transcendent. It's not some sort of creator or craftsman god. He said it's imminent and inheres and is spread throughout the world itself. Sometimes it might not be too far off to almost, you know, just identify God with the natural order itself. Now, the most important upshot of this for our purposes is that whatever happens in nature is going to occur necessarily. In its classical form, Stoicism is committed to a variety of determinism. Every event in the natural world occurs as it does by necessity. But the position's even stronger than this, right? So whatever happens not only must happen, it must also do so for a reason. And not just a good reason, the best reason. So the maximally, you know, rational divine reason. So it's not just necessary that things occur as they do, but it's also good that they occur as they do. Good in the sense that if it were impossibly to happen other than it actually does, this would be contrary to what the logos dictates. It would be against reason itself. It would be against the divine principle that governs how things in the universe proceed. Now, how do we interact with this natural world? We do so by what the Stoics call impressions. That is, whenever we undergo an experience, they talk about that in terms of receiving an impression. And these are, in some sense, physical emanations, right? The things in the natural world, they physically interact. They actually kind of shoot off little films, and they impact with our sense organs, and we undergo our conscious experiences, the things that you're all aware of from your, you know, first personal conscious point of view. These impressions are on the nature side of the division between nature and ourselves. They are just as determined and rationally governed as events in the natural order, since they're among such events. So the experiences we undergo, that is, the impressions that confront us and impact us, those aren't under our control. They're something that happens to us. To undergo an experience is to be the passive recipient of these impressions. Now, when we get to ourselves, we're the active side, the active contrast to this passive reception of impressions. What human beings can do, we are capable of standing back and reflecting on the impressions, that is, the experiences we happen to undergo. And it's up to us. We can choose how to respond to them. That is, the judgments we make when confronted with a given impression, those are up to us. The impressions aren't up to us. How we respond is. And they talk about this ability we have as a capacity. They call this volition, or choice. This capacity of volition, that is the capacity to rationally choose how to respond or how to judge our impressions, is central to being what we are. And it is, by its nature, unimpeded. The choices we make when confronted with any given impression at any given time are entirely free. And this freedom is an inalienable characteristic of what it is to be the kind of beings we are. It's a capacity to make one's own decisions, right? And this means our decisions are free from external compulsion. Everything in the natural order is determined. There's one thing that's free: how we respond to these impressions. This is something that he thinks separates us from the animals who don't have this rational capacity. They're kind of compelled to act in response to their impressions in ways that we have some choice over. So there's nothing more important about us than this capacity of volition. It's, in some sense, it is what we really are. The true self of the individual resides in this capacity. To be for us is to be capable of choice. To live as we do is to exercise this capacity of volition. So, like, our convictions, our attitudes, our intentions, our actions, they're ours in a way that nothing else is. They're determined solely by our rational responses to impressions, and are in, so, as I say, they call these things internal to the sphere of volition. So we can judge or not judge, and what we do judge when we do so, it's entirely up to us. We can desire or not desire, will or not will. We're kind of islands of freedom in a deterministic sea of natural events unfolding. So just on your handout, some of this is summed up in T2. This is from Epictetus. He says, some things are up to us and some things are not up to us. Our opinions are up to us and our impulses, desires, aversions. In short, whatever is our own doing. Our bodies are not up to us, nor our possessions, our reputations, our public offices, or that is, whatever is not our own doing. The things that are up to us are by nature free, unhindered, and unimpeded. The things that are not up to us are weak, enslaved, hindered, not our own. So remember, if you think that things naturally enslaved are free, or that things not your own are your own, you will be thwarted, miserable, and upset, and will blame both gods and men. But if you think that only what is yours is yours, and that what is not your own is, just as it is, not your own, then no one will ever coerce you. No one will hinder you. You will blame no one. You will not accuse anyone. You will not do a single thing unwillingly. You will have no enemies, and no one will harm you, because you will not be harmed at all. So, a lot of things he mentioned, your own physical body, your possessions, all the things you have, your relationships with other people, the success or failure of your projects, your reputation, all of these are outside the sphere of volition. All of these things, they're in the domain of the natural world. They're merely contingent facts about a person. They don't really have to do essentially with what you are. They're features of our experience, that's how we interact with them, rather than characteristics of ourselves. So they're external. The important thing is, external things are, they are not up to us. They are not under our control. The only thing that is completely good, unconditionally good, are the choices and judgments we make, insofar as they're the exercises of a well-ordered, rational, and virtuous disposition of volition. All of these external things, anything that you encounter and experience, anything that ultimately arises from the natural world, it's not going to have unconditional value. What is really good has to benefit its possessor under all circumstances. It has to be something that's under your control. But the benefits of any worldly item, any external good, it's at best contingent. It can be taken away, right? And in the end, we should view them as, in some sense, neither good nor bad in themselves. We should treat them as being indifferent. So all the bad feelings we have, right? Grief, fear, envy, desire, every form of anxiety. The Stoics think these result from the incorrect supposition that happiness is to be found outside of oneself. These emotions, they are not imposed on us by external circumstances. We aren't forced to feel these ways. They aren't forced on us by some sort of internal force that's beyond our control. Our feelings, as well as our behavior, are an expression of what seems right to us, conditioned by our judgments of value. And if we correct our judgments, our feelings will be corrected as well. So this is on T3. What upsets people is not things themselves, but their judgments about the things. For example, death is nothing dreadful, or else it would have appeared dreadful to Socrates. But instead, the judgment about death, that it is dreadful. That is what is dreadful. So when we are thwarted or upset or distressed, let us never blame someone else, but rather ourselves. That is, our own judgments. It's up to you whether you decide to be upset when something external happens. This also concerns not just, you know, whatever events happen to you, or it also concerns, say, the actions of others. The choices made by other people, that's not up to you either, right? And so they're of ethical significance only to them, not to you. The only thing that could be of value to you is how you choose to respond to others' actions. So again, T4, remember that what is insulting is not the person who abuses you or hits you, but the judgment about them that they are insulting. So when someone irritates you, be aware that what irritates you is your own belief. We're all annoyed by people all the time. You could choose not to be annoyed. That's up to you. So if you're going to blame someone for how you're feeling, given that you could have chosen not to be annoyed by, I guess, the annoying person, that's up to you. Them being annoying, that's not up to you. You can't control that in the same way that you can control how you respond. So what is it for us to live in agreement with nature? Well, nothing that falls outside of our own agency, nothing that belongs to nature, to the external world, could be different than it actually is. Right? This is how he's viewing nature unfolding deterministically according to this divine logos. This is what we have to accept. The only thing over which we have control is the way we respond to this. Human beings, the Stoics think, are unhappy because what they desire things that they judge to be good, but may fail to obtain or fail to prevent losing, right? Humans are unhappy because they try to avoid things they judge to be bad, but are inevitable. But we don't have to make these judgments. T5, Epictetus says, do not seek to have events happen as you want them to, but instead want them to happen as they do happen, and your life will go well. You want them to happen as they do happen because they must happen that way, right? You want to be in agreement with nature. You want to accept that things out of your control are not just out of your control, but they have to proceed as they actually do. There's nothing you could do about it in some sense one way or the other. The good news is our happiness is completely independent then of anything that happens in the external world. It doesn't matter whether you're fortunate or unfortunate. It depends only on what's in your control. It depends on your rational decisions alone, on what you choose to do, how you choose to respond to the experiences you undergo. Now, this is not easy to do, right? We have the ability to improve our own dispositions, become better at coming into agreement with nature. A lot of Stoic practice involves ways to improve oneself. It initially involves like consciously slowing down your thought processes to allow for reflection prior to judgment, right? A lot of times we like immediately respond in certain ways to our experiences. But there's a way of standing back and not feeling the emotion initially and then calmly saying, I'm not annoyed, right, when someone's annoying, rather than just immediately being annoyed. Constant vigilance is required, and it's difficult to do this. I'm not sure if I trained for years whether I'd be able to do it, right? But if you can do this, those lucky few are called sages. It's the highest and best way to live. So success in our rational judgments, it places us in accordance with nature, in accordance with the divine principle that governs nature. And in this way, this is a little odd, the Stoics think that when we do so, our minds, they're actually fragments of this divine logos, this divine universal reason that controls the universe. When we make choices, we're exercising the very same power that governs the universe. Zeus has ceded to us a portion of his governance. So to live in agreement with nature, you have to come to terms with your own internal divinity, that you have the same rational power as much as any god would have, to seek to achieve a likeness to God and to acquire complete independence from chance or fortune or anything in the external world by accepting that it has to proceed as it does and is in fact good that it proceeds as it does and act and respond accordingly. It's to live most in agreement with the unfolding of nature's rational and providential plan. This is from Marcus Aurelius. Everything that is in accord with you is in accord with me, O world. Could have said, O God, there as well. All right. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, I think there is a lot to say in favor of Stoicism. And many later philosophers, even those who are not Stoics, adopt many of its insights, albeit in a slightly modified form often. Primary among these insights is the rejection of external goods as the source of human happiness. And consequently, the rejection of acting primarily for the sake of their acquisition and their preservation. This is again from Epictetus. A person's master is someone who has power over what he wants or does not want, either to obtain it or take it away. Whoever wants to be free, therefore, let him not want or avoid anything that is up to others. Otherwise, he will necessarily be a slave. Happiness should not consist in whether one obtains one or more external goods, whether you have wealth or whether you have good reputation or fortune or power. But this desire for these external goods actually governs the lives of most of us. And if you look out at the world and try and see what people are actually aiming for, what they guide their lives in order to do, almost always it's to acquire external goods. That's what they think is valuable. If I have certain external goods, that's what will make me happy. If I have wealth, if I have fame, if I have power, if I have honor, we seek wealth, position, power, fame, pleasure. But these temporal, external, worldly goods are impermanent. They can be taken away just as readily as they can be given. And whether they're present is ultimately out of our control altogether. And even non-Stoics, as I said, broadly recognize this. So in the 8th text, this is from Augustine. It says, "But we accuse a soul of sin when we are convinced that it has abandoned higher things and chosen to enjoy inferior things. Now we admit that this movement belongs to the will alone, and that it's voluntary and therefore blameworthy, and the only useful teaching on this topic is that which condemns and checks this movement and thus serves to rescue our wills from their fall into temporal goods and turn them toward the enjoyment of the eternal good." Now here, there's a unique positive claim to turn one's will towards the external goods. This is towards God in a more Christian sense. But the passage shares with the Stoics the claim that worldly goods are inferior, that one should not invest one's happiness and make it depend on the acquisition of things in the external world. It should be turned to something more permanent, right? Not something that's ultimately out of our control. And you'll see this also in the next one. This is from Boethius in his Consolation of Philosophy. He says, Boethius is talking to Lady Philosophy, who's speaking on behalf of fortune itself, says, "You've been receiving a favor as one who has had the use of another's possessions, and you have no right to complain as if what you've lost was fully your own. You have no cause to begin groaning at me," that's fortune. "I have done you no violence. Wealth, honors, and the like are all under my jurisdiction. They are my servants and know their mistress. When I come, they come with me, and when I go, they leave as well. I can say with confidence that if the things whose loss you are bemoaning were really yours, you could have never have lost them." Again, here Boethius, he's diminishing the goods of fortune, worldly goods. And he does so for the same reason that the Stoics do. The goods of fortune are not ultimately under our control. If they're present, that is not up to us. If they cease to be and are no longer present, that's not up to us either. So one feature of whatever the highest achievable human good is that these people are sharing is something like self-sufficiency, right? Whatever human happiness is, it should be something that doesn't depend on things other than us in this way, like that are out of our control. Okay. All's well and good so far. There's some signs that things may be off. That's what I'll turn to now, the so-called problems. When we look deeper into what adopting this Stoic worldview looks like in practice, there are some things you may become a bit concerned about. So whenever I teach Epictetus' handbook, there's almost always kind of immediate resistance, if not revulsion, to some passages. So this one in particular, T10. "In the case of everything attractive or useful that you're fond of, remember to say just what sort of thing it is, beginning with the least little things. If you're fond of a jug, say, I'm fond of a jug. For then when it is broken, you will not be upset. If you kiss your child or wife, say that you're kissing a human being. For when it dies, you will not be upset." There's already, I feel the same resistance already, just in some of the sounds from the audience. Now look, I've got six kids, four of them are boys, they break things all the time. And it's annoying. Sometimes I don't care much, they just broke their own toys. I'm annoyed I paid for it and that they can no longer use it. Every once in a while they break something of mine, then I get a little bit more upset, especially if it has some sentimental value. But I think there is something important to the idea that you can stand back and just say, look, it's just an object. Objects come and go. Maybe I shouldn't be so upset, right? Like, you know, I could punish them or something, or try and inculcate better habits so they aren't going into my room and taking my things and breaking them. But you don't want to invest so much happiness in just objects that you're just going to be so upset when they're gone. It seems like a pretty big move. This seems reasonable to me, actually. I'm not so sure it's reasonable to adopt the same attitude towards my children themselves. God forbid any of my children pass away. There seems to be something off if you treat this with the same attitude you'd treat if you're just drinking coffee in the morning and you let it go out of your hand and it breaks on the ground. That's annoying. You get upset. Loss of a child seems to be something much greater than this. There's a way in which this response to your wife or your child dying, treating it just like any other inanimate object breaking, seems closer to sociopathy than an appropriate way to modulate one's emotions. This applies not just in those cases, but also other people's actions. Remember, those are out in the external world too. Those aren't under your control. So T11, never say about anything, I've lost it, but instead, I've given it back. Did your child die? It was given back. Did your wife die? She was given back. My land was taken, so this too was given back. But the person who took it was bad. How does the way that the giver asks for it back concern you? As long as he gives it, take care of it as something that is not your own, just as travelers treat an inn. There should be, I think, as I was saying before, a proper recognition that the fortunes of the external world are impermanent. They aren't under your control. You shouldn't think of them as the sorts of things that are always going to be in your possession. They're by their very nature things that are going to perish. I don't think, though, that when you are mourning your child's death, it's that you haven't properly assessed the kind of thing they are. I'm not sad because I forgot that my child wasn't immortal. Does seem like there should be certain reasons to be upset when, as you say, when someone takes your land or they do so for bad or unjust reasons. Now, this is a TI talk, and so I thought it would be appropriate to develop this thought by turning to some passages from Aquinas himself. Though he engages Stoicism throughout his corpus, one of the most incisive treatments of it is in his commentary on the book of Job. And this shouldn't be too surprising, given that that book of the Bible concerns the proper way to respond to immense suffering through the loss of what we've been calling external goods. Job's good fortune is eradicated. His possessions are stolen or destroyed. His family members are killed. His healthy body is replaced with painful illness. The Stoic, you would think, would, under these circumstances, say, if you were upset by this, all of these bad things happening, that is ultimately up to you. And the appropriate thing to do is be in agreement with nature, yes? To say that all I will is that things happen as nature unfolds, necessarily. Here is how Aquinas thinks one ought to respond. He says, there were two opinions held by ancient philosophers about the passions. The Stoics said that there was no place in the wise man for sorrow. The Peripatetics, that is the Aristotelians, said that the wise man is indeed sad, but in sad things he conducts himself with a moderation in accord with reason. This opinion accords with the truth. He's going in with the Aristotle side of things. For reason does not take away the condition of nature. It is natural to sensible nature to rejoice and be pleased about thinning things, and grieve and feel pain about harmful things. So reason does not take away this natural disposition, but so moderates it, that reason is not deflected from its right course because of sorrow. This opinion accords with Holy Scripture, which places sorrow in Christ, in whom there is every fullness of virtue and wisdom. In doing this, he is adopting what Aristotle has come to be known as his doctrine of the mean. The feelings one has, they come in degrees. And the virtuous orientation occupies a kind of middle ground between excess and defect. One could be too sad, or one could be not sad enough. There is an appropriate amount of sadness that one should feel on a given occasion, depending on what the situation is. It's the amount that right practical reason would dictate one should have. Now, rational moderation, there is a way in which you could employ reason to try and rein in or control the passions and feelings that you're having. And this would, if you do it well, would prevent sadness or sorrow from improperly overcoming yourself. And as he says, it would avoid deflecting us from our right course. But the proper defense against excess isn't annihilation. That would lead to an opposite but no less vicious orientation of insensibility. It's to swing from the vice of excess to the vice of deficiency. This comes up all the time, him treating feelings like this. In the Summa, I think this is 13, he's talking about anger. You might think the Stoic could think you should never be angry about anything. I mean, it's up to you. You could choose to be angry or not. No one likes being angry. So why are you putting yourself in the position of undergoing a feeling that's pretty unpleasant to be in? He says, evil is found in passion in respect of the passion's quantity, that is, in respect of its excess or deficiency, and thus evil may be found in anger, when, to wit, one is angry more or less than right reason demands. But if one is angry in accordance with right reason, one's anger is deserving of praise. The Stoics designated anger and all the other passions as emotions opposed to the order of reason, and accordingly they deemed anger and all other passions to be evil. But anger and the other passions of the soul are movements of the sensitive appetite, whether they be moderated or not according to reason. In this sense, anger's not always evil. He's got a name for the appropriate amount of anger. It's righteous anger. There are things that you should be angry about, right? That the normal and appropriate response is anger. You don't want to go nuts and go too angry, but if you confront something that deserves by reason to have an anger as a response and you don't feel any anger at all, he thinks that's just as much of a problem as being too angry. For every situation, there is an appropriate amount, the rational amount, and reason should be trying to get you to be feeling things the right way, not just not doing them at all. This doesn't mean that one should take the presence or absence of external goods to fully determine whether you are living a happy life. External goods should not be the principal aim for the sake of which one acts. So we'll agree with Boethius and Augustine and the Stoics. Everyone's on board with this. But that doesn't mean they aren't without any value. They still have what he calls instrumental value. This is a long one. I don't think I'll read this. Second sentence says, for the Stoics said that exterior goods were not goods of man, and that there could be no sorrow for their loss in the soul of the wise man. But the opinion of the Peripatetics, the Aristotelians, was that some of the goods of man are truly exterior goods, though they're certainly not the principal ones, they're not the main ones. Nevertheless, they are like instruments ordered to the principal good of man, which is the good of the mind. That is, sometimes things are good, these external things to have, because they help us to lead a better life, right? Like, let's say you have enough money to get food and shelter and clothing, and let's say your body's healthy. These are genuinely good things because they enable you to do what's really good, which is live a proper, rational, virtuous life, he thinks, right? If you are sick and put into a coma, that's certainly going to lessen the number of times that you can go out and contemplate the circular motion of the heavens or act justly or manifest a proper, virtuous, rational life. So it's perfectly rational to be saddened by the loss of some external goods and to be pleased by their presence, given that they do play a role in our living a flourishing human life. You shouldn't be too upset by their loss or too pleased with their presence. That's not what a good life consists in, but they do have some value. I'll just mention briefly, he mentions that this accords with Holy Scripture, and this is true all over the place. So at various places he mentions, you know, in the first book of Genesis, God looked upon his creation and he sees that it is good. And we should appreciate it and take joy in what is good. And the psalmist says, delight in the Lord, not just in him, but in his creation as well. And in the specific passage earlier, he mentions that, you know, Jesus suffers agony of soul in the Garden of Gethsemane and is driven to despair on the cross when he cries, why hast thou forsaken me? But, you know, at no point in Christ's passion is he serene or untroubled. But this isn't weakness. This isn't vice, and it's not ignorance. Christ isn't incorrectly judging what he undergoes as bad, and they're thinking this is not a failure to agree with nature. To suffer when suffering is appropriate, that's what he thinks is to agree with nature. It's to treat what right reason determines to be a genuine source of sadness correctly. So Christ's suffering isn't inappropriate. It's among the greatest manifestations of his humanity. There's one more issue I want to bring up with the time I have left. Somewhat deeper issue. This will initially seem like I'm going off on a tangent or a different topic, but be patient and I will bring it in. There are a lot of ways in which the Stoics' arguments parallel another pretty famous argument that you'll find in philosophy, later philosophy, something that was called the argument from illusion. I'm not going to go through every detail of this argument, but basically, you imagine a situation you're in which you're undergoing an illusory experience or a hallucinatory experience. So Lady Macbeth is hallucinating a bloody dagger, right? Not only is there nothing that's red in front of her, there's no dagger at all. So it's always possible for some physical feature to appear differently than it really is. But when things do appear you this way, like try and imagine you're in this situation where you're actually undergoing the illusory experience, there has to be some feature which actually does possess the feature you're aware of it having. There's something red, right? Like you are experiencing red. You're experiencing something red, but we know that it can't be the dagger itself. There is no dagger, but something has to be red. What is the thing that you're actually experiencing and are acquainted with that has the red property? Right? There's three, since the appearing physical object does not possess that feature, which we are immediately aware of in the illusory situation, it can't be the physical object. They give a name to these things, the things we are aware of. They're classically called sense data. So that's what we're immediately aware of and experience, sense data, something entirely private to our own conscious experiences, not anything out in the world. Now, again, I'm mostly concerned here with where this argument leads us and what ultimately motivates it rather than the argument itself. Plenty of people don't like this argument for various reasons. But its upshot, traditionally, has been called the veil of perception. We don't directly experience anything in the physical world. What our experiences of are something private, these sense data. And this makes it hard to get the world back. Right? A lot of work is done, like, if the only thing we're really encountering is something private and internal to us, how can we ever make judgments about anything in the world? We're never actually engaging it perceptually. It's difficult to do, right? Once you give up on the world, it's hard to get it back. And the main motivation is something like safety, right? Epistemological safety. You want to avoid error, things being other than they're perceived to be. This is Bertrand Russell. He was a sense data proponent, at least early in his life. He says, is there any knowledge in the world which is so certain that no reasonable man could doubt it? That's what you want. You could doubt whether there's a dagger in front of you. Sometimes there isn't, even though you're experiencing it, right? You could doubt that the dagger's red. It might not be red. That might just be illusory. What you can't doubt is that you're undergoing an experience of a red dagger, right? You can't, that's not something you could doubt. That's as clear as could be. So whether your judgments are right or wrong about what you're really experiencing, it no longer depends on the contingencies of the world. It's entirely self-sufficient. In seeking this safety, you're seeking an absolutely firm ground upon which error is impossible. But you kind of reduce yourself to a metaphysical point, a conscious point, right? You gain security, but at what cost? You lose the world itself, right? All there is you, and all you are a conscious thing aware of these private sense data. Now, the reason I mention any of this is I think a parallel fate attends the Stoic sage. What motivates the Stoic is analogous to what motivates this sense datum theorist. This is in T17. You can be invincible if you do not enter any contest in which victory is not up to you. This is another attempt to achieve something like safety. And in this case, it's not an epistemological safe haven one seeks. It's a practical safe haven. Just as you cannot guarantee that your experience of the world are not illusory, you can't guarantee that any external goods in the world will be yours. It's not under your control. But in seeking safety, in seeking this absolute control, absolute self-sufficiency, the Stoic reduces themselves to a metaphysical point as well. This time it's a point of agency, a point of mere will and volition. That's all you become. Your body's external, the world's external. All that you are is a thing that judges, a thing that wills. You abandon, in some sense, the world itself and let it proceed as if you weren't a part of it. Moreover, the desire for this safety, it's not just open to criticism because of where it leads. The desire itself reveals a very different attitude from the other philosophers like Aquinas that I've mentioned. On this line of thinking, the Stoics are guilty of seeing sin as somehow identical with undergoing the passions. And the answer to a man's woe is kind of inoculating one against these passions altogether. But there's a way in which this is a form of righteousness, of self-righteousness, a kind of self-congratulatory pride in your own power to overcome sin and error without any external assistance. It is entirely within your power to be completely good. The Stoic sage is, in this way, divine. They are self-sufficient, tiny gods embodying the same divinity that governs the universe. So the Stoic sage is fully self-sufficient and becomes one with the divine. That's one side. On the other side, you have the view that the good man, the virtuous man, of at least the sort of Christianized Aristotelian tradition I'm appealing to. On this alternative, human beings are fallen and not self-sufficient. They don't aim to become divine, but recognize that they're in need of divine assistance in the light of divine grace. So this is the last line from Aquinas. Hence, man cannot be restored by himself, but he requires the light of grace to be poured upon him anew. The result of this kind of Stoic, prideful orientation is, in a way, to give up on a properly human life itself, or at least one of the inelimitable elements of what makes human life distinctively human. Having these appropriate feelings, having human sentimentality, it's not a weakness, but one of the great features of being a human, living a human life. It allows us to take pleasure in what is genuinely good and feel sorrow when one's confronted with the all too real evils and misfortunes that surround us. A proper orientation towards both the pleasures and sorrows of life is what makes us human, or at least what makes a good human life good. And our humanity includes the recognition that we are not and cannot be entirely self-sufficient, that even though we have wills, it is not entirely up to us. To be a human being is in part to be in need of God's grace. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.